"Will it be a cremation, then?" Jack asked. He, for one, devoutly hoped that it would not. This could mean that Daisy would then be in three phases at once, which was a mind-blowing prospect. So literal, murmured Aunt Celia, meaning Jack. How rare and precious it is to see poetry in a little child. I am constantly being reminded of how I have, in Daisy, a being quite unique.
To hurt it all.
There was nothing in this last statement with which anybody could quarrel, and nobody did. Even little Tommy can come, Daisy was now burbling. You come and see my little pussy now, Mummy and Daddy. He's getting bigger and bigger and got ever so long claws. Aunt Celia allowed herself to be led off to view what sounded like an ominously developing little Tommy. Uncle Parker remained. I'll take a look at him later, he promised Daisy. Little beggar, he added, as the door closed behind the pair. I may as well tell you, he continued, that the real object of our visit is to persuade Daisy to return home. There was, at this intelligence, a great sigh of relief from everybody except Grandma and Rosie. The truth of the matter is, he told them, that her mother is pining for her. She can stop here forever, so far as I am concerned, but you know how Celia is. She's also a touch concerned, to put it bluntly, that if Daisy stops much longer among you lot, she'll get all the poetry knocked out of her. We are certainly all getting a lot knocked out of us, William told him, as Mr. Bagthorpe himself would have, had he been present. The point being, Uncle Parker said, that Daisy has got herself pretty well dug in here, latterly, and is also considerably attached to her grandmother, as who can blame her? He here gallantly saluted Grandma, who ignored him. An inducement is therefore called for, and so, what with one thing and another, and all of you on a diet of beetroot and whatever, we thought of holding a banquet. The Bagthorpes were rendered quite blank by this. We are calling it a banquet, Uncle Parker told them, seeing their surprise, partly because it will indeed be a banquet, with every gastronomic delicacy in or out of season, and partly because Celia has now become irremediably nervous at the very sound of the word party. Given the long Bagthorpe history of making a clean sweep of party tables, and usually burning out their locality to boot, this was hardly surprising. The Bagthorpes, however, were still not clear what exactly was being suggested. "Do you mean a homecoming party for Daisy?" Rosie asked. "That," he replied, "is precisely it." "At your house?" she asked, incredulously. "At the Knoll?" "Where else?" he returned. "But what about Aunt Celia?" Jack asked. "What about her vibrations and things?" Aunt Celia shared with Mr. Bagthorpe an immovable conviction that people gave off vibrations. Given the kind of unsettled childhood they had probably had with Grandma, this was not, perhaps, surprising. Mr. Bagthorpe's main obsession was with his study. He was very funny about whom he would let in, and had once even stopped the vicar from entering. He was so frightened of the effect Mrs. Fosdyke would have on the vibrations in there that he actually vacuumed and dusted it himself. He said this was because there were important papers in there that must not be disturbed, but his family knew what the real reason was. It was probable that Mrs. Fosdyke did as well. Mr. Bagthorpe, by and large, discouraged all visitors from Unicorn House by dint of shouting and general want of hospitable behavior. He did not, however, place an embargo on visits from the Parkers. Aunt Celia's vibrations, he claimed, were so wishy-washy as to be virtually non-existent, and Uncle Parker's so superficial as to be likewise. The main reason he let them come, however, he did not, after all, underestimate the power of Daisy's vibrations, was that he and Uncle Parker carried on this long-standing feud. They would conduct frequent and protracted rows, and Mr. Bagthorpe usually made notes afterward, and used some of the dialogue in his television scripts. Uncle Parker had once threatened to sue him over this, on the grounds that anything he, Uncle Parker, might say was copyright. Aunt Celia's obsession with vibrations was of a different order from that of her brother. She was affected by everybody's vibrations, though she did, as Mr. Bagthorpe once sardonically pointed out, seem to have a remarkable immunity to those of her unholy daughter. Aunt Celia had then replied that he was confusing vibrations with charisma, which shone out from Daisy, she claimed, like a halo. Aunt Celia spent a lot of time writing poetry and throwing pots, or else thinking about these activities. She would spend hours just gazing at things. Uncle Parker let her because he loved her to distraction. He protected her as far as possible from the vibrations of the rest of the world, but she was so easily upset that she would often have to lie for hours in a darkened room after hearing a harsh word spoken. The Bagthorpes, then, had not for years crossed the threshold of the knoll, apart from the odd occasion when Mr. Bagthorpe had gone storming up there uninvited, having just thought of a parting shot in whatever was the current battle of words. Uncle Parker had told them that they could not be invited there because of the threat it would present to his wife's sanity. "Your combined vibrations," he had said, "are, you will concede, formidable. I do not necessarily say malignant, but formidable." Nobody cared much whether they visited the knoll or not, and so the absence of invitations to do so had never given the Bagthorpes much pause, and the present summons was naturally something of a shock. "This is really most kind of you, Russell," Mrs. Bagthorpe now said. "How exciting it sounds! A banquet!" Here Mrs. Fosdyke was heard to snort. She was probably trying to convey her conviction that the disasters attending a Bagthorpe party were in direct proportion to its ambitiousness. At this rate, a banquet could easily involve fatalities, of which there had been none so far. Banquets were quite frequently featured in her Friday Night Dracula films, and had therefore already become associated in her mind with dismemberment and much blood. "How many courses does a banquet have?" inquired William with interest. "Don't we keep eating courses till we're cramful, and then make ourselves sick to make room for more?" "Something like that," Uncle Parker agreed, "though I hope you'll all have the grace to be sick out of the sight of Aunt Celia." "Of Celia?" "Will there be a boar's head?" Rosie wanted to know. At this, Mrs. Fosdyke again snorted. She considered herself the best producer of party fare in the country, if not the world, but had never to date even considered a boar's head. She had only a confused notion of what it was. "Anyone'd think," she told Madames Pye and Bates in the Fiddler's Arms that night, that lot had never ate in their lives. The food I've given 'em! I've done 'em enough stuffed eggs in my time to build the Eiffel Tower with, and the gâteau I've done stretched to the Land's End. Boar's head! I reckon I've seen some of them, at least I think I have, on them horrible banquets on Dracula, and I reckon they're horrible great enormous things with snouts and jelly all over and oranges in their mouths instead of teeth." Her cronies shuddered sympathetically at this description. "Whatever next?" exclaimed Mrs. Pye. This was a purely rhetorical remark, but Mrs. Fosdyke went inexorably on to tell them whatever next. "They was all ordering that Mr. Parker what they wanted, as if they was a bunch of cannibals. All fancy foreign stuff it sounded, and talking about syllabubs and venison and spits. Oh, you can't imagine." "And will that wife of his do all that?" inquired Mrs. Bates incredulously. She had often heard Mrs. Fosdyke's assessment of Aunt Celia, which was, by and large, that she was only half there. "Her?" echoed Mrs. Fosdyke. "She could no more stick an orange in a pig's mouth than she could fly. One of them vegetarians, I told you, never hardly touches anything but lettuce." She went on to tell them what she had heard Uncle Parker explaining to the Bagthorpes, which was that, as Aunt Celia was so highly strung and easily unhinged at the sight and smell of strong meat, a firm of London caterers was being called in to make all the necessary culinary arrangements. He had then, realizing that Mrs. Fosdyke was within earshot, and that her sensibilities might be bruised by hearing all this, gone on to invite herself to attend, in a supervisory capacity. "Keep an eye on things, you know," he told her. He had a fair grasp of psychology, he needed to have, and knew how to butter Mrs. Fosdyke up. "And to tell you the truth, the one thing I really hanker for is a supply of your remarkable stuffed eggs. Could teach that lot a thing or two." "Shall you go, then?" asked Mrs. Fosdyke's friend, eagerly. "Ooh, I should, glad," urged Mrs. Pye. "They say it's like Buckingham Palace inside." Who they were was not clear, given Uncle Parker's reluctance to let people and their vibrations over the threshold of the knoll. To Mrs. Fosdyke, the Parker residence sounded very little like Buckingham Palace. She well knew that Daisy Parker was allowed to write her thoughts on the walls there, and had started several fires there during her pyromaniac phase. It seemed unlikely that the royal children had ever been granted these prerogatives. But Madames Pye and Bates were dedicated inspectors of the interiors of other people's houses, even if they sometimes had to settle for second-hand accounts rather than a personal inventory. They may have acquired some information from somewhere. Mrs. Fosdyke allowed her friends to urge her acceptance for a little longer, and then assented with a show of reluctance. "'Suppose I might as well,' she told them. "'If all that foreign stuff ain't fit to eat, they can always fall back on my stuffed eggs.' Mrs. Fosdyke really did have an unconscious gift for prophecy. She had not meant this last statement literally at all. Next day, then, Mrs. Fosdyke indicated her willingness to attend the homecoming banquet at the Knoll, with the proviso that there should be no candles and no crackers. "'A banquet, by its very nature, does not have crackers,' Mrs. Bagthorpe assured her, "'and as the evenings are still light, there will be no need of candles. "'I am sure the occasion will pass off beautifully. "'We are all so looking forward to it.' "'They were, even Mr. Bagthorpe, though he would not admit to it. "'It is like Russell,' he declared, "'to take a sledgehammer to crack a nut. "'Surely to God he could have rehabilitated his daughter "'without this kind of masquerade.' I may or I may not go. It will depend whether I feel I can face such rich and unwholesome food, after a taste of nutrition as it should be. He had been given an outline of the proposed courses of the banquet, and was very dismissive about them. "'We shall all be furred up for weeks afterward,' he said. "'Menus of that order are totally out of date. They were drawn up when people knew nothing of cholesterol and polyunsaturated fat and vitamins.' Mr. Bagthorpe, of course, still knew very little about these matters, but he was not the man to let this stop his delivering a lecture about them. Mr. Bagthorpe could deliver a lecture about anything, given one or two half-truths.